Twirling his fingers, Barnwell gestured to the waitress for another round of coffee. "Nice world," Silas said. "Tell me one nice thing about the human race."
"That girl," Max said.
"What girl?" Barnwell asked.
"The one in hiding, the one you thought was Esther's niece," he said.
"Well, no relation at all. She's from another part of Poland entirely."
"Still, she is a Jewish girl in trouble."
"Yes," Barnwell said.
"Esther and I would like to bring that girl to America," Max said.
Both men looked at Max as though they had both misheard him.
"She's not yours, Max, and she's not Esther's," Silas said, "and she comes with a $50,000 price tag."
"She's a Jewish girl in trouble. That makes her mine. It makes her Esther's. You say her family is probably dead, like my family. If we do not help her, who will?"
"The life of one girl doesn't make much difference in a war this big," Barnwell answered.
"I think it does," Max answered.
"But you don't have $50,000 cash," the congressman said, with finality, rising from the table with the air of a man who has spent enough time on a disagreeable subject. "Nobody in this town has that kind of cash."
"Except you," Silas said. "Elect a man to Congress in this state, and he's a millionaire in 4 years. Tell me how it works, Barnwell."
"God smiles on lambs and fools," Barnwell answered.
That night, Max took Esther out on the veranda overlooking the Waterford River, and together they watched the sun gild a low-lying herd of clouds with an unearthly, brokered gold. They drank schnapps from small crystal glasses. It was a ritual that celebrated their prosperity and their need to relax after the endless labors of their first years in the town. Max could not figure out a way to tell the woman he loved best in the world that she had lost her entire family. Esther came from a family of enormous intimacy and affection, and he did not know how to tell her that her Europe had died. Max had a second schnapps, and then told her in Yiddish. For 6 days, Esther Russoff mourned, and then a young rabbi conducted Sabbath services in their house. Max and Esther pledged to build a synagogue in Waterford to honor their families. When Shiva was over, Esther lay in Max's arms again and whispered to him before they went to sleep.
"That girl, Max, the one that Barnwell mentioned to you."
"I've been thinking of her too," Max said.
"What can we do?"
"Sell everything," Max replied. "This house, the department store, the supermarket. Start again."
"Can we get $50,000? It's a lot. Too much, maybe."
"The bank will lend us the difference," Max said. "I am sure of it."
"Then this is what we will do," Esther said.
"Yes," Max said.
"You would do it whether I agreed or not," Esther said. "I know you, my husband. I am smart enough to go along with what you have already decided. But it is right, even if it may take away from our own children."
"How does it hurt our children to save another child?" Max asked.
In the following months, Max sold the department store to the Belk's chain out of Charlotte, sold the food market to a retailer out of Charleston, and sold their house on Dolphin Street to a lieutenant general in the Marine Corps stationed on Pollock Island and nearing retirement age. He wired the $50,000 to Barnwell Middleton in Washington and received back a sobering telegram that stated how long the odds were and how improbable it was that this rescue could actually be consummated. But Barnwell Middleton pledged he would try his best. Max had not sold the building of the small store that he had first opened in Waterford so many years before, and it was empty. The Russoff family moved back into the top floor, and in no time, Max and Esther were back in business. Nearly a year passed before Max received a telegram from Barnwell Middleton informing him that a merchant ship would arrive in the small port of Waterford on July 18, 1944. A girl named Ruth Graubart was listed among the passengers. Max called his wife and told her the good news, then called Silas McCall, who told the news to Ginny Penn. The news moved from house to house in Waterford, the way news travels in small towns, light and frisky and buoyant because the story brought such a sense of joy into a world too familiar with the news of hometown boys dying overseas. When the boat arrived in Waterford, a pretty teenage girl walked down the gangplank, accompanied with grave formality by the ship's captain. She looked shy and bewildered as she heard the noise begin in the crowd. Meeting Max and Esther, who greeted her in Yiddish, she curtsied. Max wept and opened his arms to her. When she rushed into them and buried her head in his great chest, the town roared out its greeting to her. It let her know that she was part of Waterford, South Carolina, from that day forward, that she had found her home. The town would take the girl, Ruth Graubart, into their hearts and watch her finish high school and come of age to marry George Fox. The town would be there when she bore her first child, Shyla, and would be there when Ruth buried that same child. But what the town remembered most and best was that first moment when the Jewish orphan, ransomed by strangers, touched down on Waterford soil for the first time and flew into the arms of the great Jew. Silas McCall would later tell his grandchildren that when he watched the girl's arrival, it marked the first time he was certain that America would win the war. No matter how many times he told the story to his grandchildren about Ruth's arrival, he always ended it the same way, and it always gave the McCall children goosebumps when he got to the end. "The town roared," he would say. "The town just roared." But Ruth told her own story to no one in Waterford except to her husband and her daughter Shyla, until she told it to me in the spring of 1986, after we had reconciled and I had returned to the town with her granddaughter, Leah, to help my mother die. It was only when Ruth had told me about her terrible history in Poland that I learned, at last, the identity of the Lady of Coins. Chapter 25. I drove my grandfather, Silas McCall, over to Waterford to pick up Jenny Penn from the nursing home. I left my brothers at my grandparents' house as they finished off a ramp for Jenny Penn's wheelchair. My grandfather was a compact, cigarette-smoking southerner, observant, but a man of few words. "Be glad to get Jenny Penn home?" I asked.
"Don't have much choice," Silas said. "She likes to drive the nurses crazy."
"Dad all right?"
"Slept it off, then caught a ride to town."
We put my grandmother in the back seat, exhausted by the effort and emotion caused by the mechanics of checking out of the home. Bureaucracy always requires an expenditure of energy that is too much to ask, especially of the very old and very sick. Jenny Penn did not even wave back at the nurses who lined the porch to bid her farewell.
"Monsters," she said, as Silas and I waved to them. "Leeches, bedpan emptiers, disease spreaders, penicillin fungi. They should not be allowed to touch genuine ladies or women of pure refinement."
"I thought they were nice," Silas said quietly, almost an aside.
"You never came to see me once," Jenny Penn hissed. "Better had I married Ulysses S. Grant than the traitorous wretch Silas McCall."
"Could you stop off at the feed store?" my grandfather asked me. "I'd like to buy a muzzle." "Grandpa came to see you every day, Jenny Penn," I said.
"My grandchildren deserted me. The whole town was on a death watch. It would have exploded with joy at the news of my demise."
"I'd have led the parade down Main Street," Silas muttered. "Don't egg her on," I warned, touching his wrist. "Jenny Penn, my brothers are all down. We spent the day building you a wheelchair ramp."
"That's what you call a homecoming gift, a wheelchair ramp?"
"I oversaw the preliminaries," I said. "It'll be great." My four brothers were gathered at their grandparents' house when I drove up into the yard. The house had aged well and looked distinguished among the modern beach houses that had sprung up around it. Behind it, the 14th hole of a golf course, designed by Robert Trent Jones, made a dogleg away from the backyard. A golf cart bearing two sedate and dignified retirees drifted as soundlessly as a sailing ship toward the distant green. Four female white-tailed deer, beautiful in their streamlined thinness, fed on the high grasses in the rough. When I was a boy, I thought, the island was wild, and you could look forever and never find a golf ball. But everything's different from when I was a boy. Except, I thought, my grandparents were the same. Always they had seemed peculiar and unsuitable. They had also appeared conjoined by habit and not by love. It hurt Jenny Penn that we, her grandsons, preferred Silas to her, and that we loved him with a fierce attachment that she would never know. But we would disagree with that assessment, and tell her with clarity and accuracy that we loved her exactly as much as she would allow us to, and that was always dependent on the ungovernable valences of her moods. "The boys," I said.
"Best boys in the world," Silas added.
"They'll do in a pinch,"
Jenny Penn said, but I could tell she was both excited to be home and to have a reception committee waiting for her. My brothers let out a cheer and ran down to greet her. They pounded on the side of the car and kept up their cheering until even the doer Jenny Penn had to smile. When she smiled, all four boys pretended to feel dizzy and fell onto their backs in a dead faint.
"They've always been goofy as puppies," she said,
as Silas helped her out of the car and I retrieved the wheelchair from the porch. T ran up the new ramp that lent the whole yard the smell of fresh lumber. He lay down at the top of the ramp and yelled to Jenny Penn, "Hey, old woman!" Jenny Penn flared and said,
"Don't you call me old woman, or I'll switch you till it thunders."
"Look, Jenny Penn," T said happily, "perfect angle."
Then, pretending he was a dead man in a B-movie, T let himself roll down the ramp and out onto the sidewalk.
"It needs some varnish," Jenny Penn said. "I detest raw wood. It offends my aesthetic."
"It's wonderful to see you too, Grandma," Dallas said.
"Thank you, boys, for building the ramp,"
Dupree added in a girlish voice.
"Not even a near-death experience changed her one iota, boys," Silas said, glumly pushing her up the ramp. "She'll be hell until she dies."
"That's my plan," she said. In the middle of the ramp, my brothers stopped the wheelchair and began kissing her in welcome. They kissed her face and neck and tickled her ribs. They kissed her eyes and cheeks and forehead until she began to fend them off with her cane. They retreated from her, laughing, then pounced on her again when Silas maneuvered her near the front door. She seemed to both welcome and barely tolerate the kisses. It was their attention she craved, not their touch. She had always considered kissing to be the most overrated of human activities. Outside, we sat around the front porch as John Harden sanded the ramp, smoothing down the rough spots. Of all of us, he was the only true carpenter, and there was nothing he could not do with his hands. Though gifted, he was also unemployable, since he could never take the pressure that even the most serene workplace made inevitable. We watched him sand the fresh lumber, admiring the economy of his labor. T broke the silence by saying,
"Let's face it, Jenny Penn's an asshole. Am I the only one that's noticed it?"
"Who?" Dupree said. "That sweet old thing?"
Leah walked out onto the back porch after having read Jenny Penn a poem she had written in honor of her homecoming.
"Did Jenny Penn like your poem, darling?"
her Uncle Dupree asked.
"I couldn't tell," Leah said. "She said she did."
"Don't worry about it," T said. "Being nice is out of character."
"Too much to ask," Dallas agreed.
"Did all of you know my mother?"
Leah asked my brothers, who were surprised at the question. They gathered around her solicitously.
"Sure, Leah," Dupree said. "What do you want to know? What do you remember most about Shyla?"
"I don't remember much about having a mother, Uncle Dupree," Leah said.
"You sure had a nice one, darling," Dallas said.
"Pretty as a picture, just like you," T added.
"Did all of you like her?" Leah asked.
"Like her?" Dupree said. "We were all in love with your mama. Don't know if your daddy told you, but that was one sexy girl."
"Best dancer I ever saw," T said. "I never saw anyone who could do the shag as well as she could."
"What's the shag?"
"A girl born in South Carolina doesn't know what the shag is," Dupree said. "That's a crime against humanity."
"Means your daddy ain't worth a damn," said T.
"They don't do the shag in Italy, boys," I defended myself. "I might as well teach you the hula."
"No excuses," Dupree said. "Let me pull my pickup truck close to the porch and I'll put on a tape. There's a tragic gap in my niece's education."
"Be better if the girl had been raised in a South Carolina orphanage," Dallas teased. "Makes me ashamed you're my brother, Jack."
"Look at Dupree with that pickup truck," John Harden sneered. "He loves playing dirt ball better than anybody I've ever seen."
"Dupree's a redneck at heart," T said. "A redneck wannabe. It's the lowest form of life."
Dupree pulled his truck up to the porch, which was windburnt from exposure to the sea. He put in a tape and turned the volume up full blast.
"Carolina beach music," Dupree said, coming up on the porch. "The holiest sound on earth." Your uncles will now make up for your father's negligence, Dallas said. In fact, I might file a civil suit against him.
Dupree took Leah's hand and began showing her the steps. I grabbed tea and began to dance, and Leah watched with fascination, never having seen me dance before.
The essence of the shag, Leah, I said, is to put on a face of utter coolness. The shag is not about passion. It's about summer and secret desires and attitude. You have to have an utterly careless expression on your face.
Who is this guy, Plato? We're just teaching the kid how to dance, Dupree said.
The reason I can dance the girl's part, T said to Leah, is because I'm younger, and they used to force me to be the girl when they practiced the shag.
Dallas asked Leah to dance when the next song, Double Shot of My Baby's Love, came blasting out of the truck.
Your mother was the greatest shag dancer that ever lived, Dallas said.
She could dance any dance there was, Dupree said.
Hey, tell me Leah's not getting it fast, Dallas said in admiration.
Got her mother's blood, T said. This girl was born to shag, and I got the dance after John Harden. I'm going to teach her the dirty shag.
The dirty shag? Leah squealed. Sounds like fun.
Leah became a lifelong lover of uncles on that day. She was consumed and enlarged by the joyous attention of her uncles, and that pleasure shone in her face. Her body began to move in harmony with the rhythm, and there seemed a ripening in the center of her girlhood as she spun in the full flood of her uncle's admiration. They lined up to dance with her and argued whose turn it was. They turned an afternoon on a porch into a promenade of bright, strange glamour she would remember all her life. She had been selected, singled out, and was as powerful as a fairy tale queen, surrounded by her cheering, high-spirited armies. By the end of that day, she could shag as well as any of her uncles. I watched every single dance Leah danced with my brothers, whose sweetness moved me greatly. Then Dupree tapped me on the shoulder and said,
"Next song's for you and Leah to dance to."
The song, Save the Last Dance for Me, by the Drifters, filled the air, and Leah noticed the change in me.
"What's wrong, Daddy?"
she asked, as I took her hand and asked for the privilege of this dance.
"Could you rewind so that I go back to the beginning, Dupree?" I asked. "I've got to explain the significance of this song."
Then I turned to Leah. "Remember the story of me and Mama falling in love?" I asked.
"The night the house fell into the sea?" Leah asked.
"Same one. Well, when Mama and I danced in that room alone when everyone had run out of the house, we danced the shag."
"I didn't know that."
"I should have taught you how to do it. My brothers are right."
"It's okay, Daddy. You taught me lots of things."
"This was your mama's and my favorite song. We fell in love dancing to it."
Leah had never danced with me, but she heard the humming of her uncles as they murmured with pleasure, watching us move to the words of the wonderful song.
They clapped and stomped their feet and wolf-whistled at Leah as I spun her around on the weather-beaten porch. Her greatest surprise was that she couldn't shag as well as I did, and she said so. And as we danced, I saw her slowly turning into a mirror image of Shiloh. And then the tears came. They came at last.
She didn't notice that I was weeping until my brothers grew quiet. We stopped dancing, and I sat down on the porch steps. My child held me as the song her mother and I had loved best in the world completely undid me. I could bear the memory, but I could not bear the music that made the memory such a killing thing.
Chapter 26. In early May, a month after our return, at Lucy's insistence, I drove her up Highway 17 toward Charleston and the Trappist Monastery out at Mepkin Abbey. Though she was vague about the reasons for her visit, she did mention she wanted to have Father Jude hear her confession. Ever since I had brought Father Jude to my mother's hospital bed, where he gave her extreme unction, I suspected there was more to this relationship than penitent and confessor, but I no longer thought, as we had when we were younger, that they were lovers. I had questioned Lucy, but she was a master of indirection. There was no query she could not succeed at not answering. The English language on her tongue became a smokescreen, without her eyes changing expression in the least. As we drove to Charleston, I looked over at her. She looked calm and pretty. For a long time I had wanted to get her off by herself,
to ask her all the unanswered questions I had stored up from childhood and had thought of again with my eyes bandaged in Rome. Though I lacked a clear strategy for milking her of this concealed trove of knowledge, I wanted to initiate the inquiry without arousing suspicion.
"I've had some wonderful news," she said suddenly, stretching her arms in the sunlight.
Only since she developed leukemia could Lucy be talked into using her seatbelt. She had always made it a point of honor not to wear one, and it was odd for me to see her safely buckled up.
"I want to share it with you, but I want you to promise not to tell another living soul."
"I promise to tell only one other person," I said. "Otherwise I find myself untrustworthy. Secrets are too much of a burden to me."
"The Pope just annulled my marriage to your father. I can receive the sacraments again. Dr. Pitts and I got remarried in the church yesterday."
"Well, thanks for inviting your children."
"We didn't want to make a fuss," she said. "I wrote the Pope a thank you note."
"You had 5 kids with Dad," I said.
"It was all a terrible mistake. I feel like I've awakened from a bad dream."
"Does that mean we're all bastards?" I asked, adjusting the rearview mirror. Lucy giggled and said,
"It never occurred to me. Oh, dear, how comical. Yes, I imagine it does. I didn't even think to ask. Jude'll know."
"So the marriage never happened. All that pain and grief and suffering, none of it happened," I said.
"Everything happened," Lucy explained, "but the church wiped the slate clean. There's no record of it happening."
"I'm a record of it happening," I insisted.
"No," Lucy said, "you're annulled."
"If I'm nothing, I can't be driving this car," I shouted. "I don't exist. I'm not here. My parents were never married, and I was never born. Grab the wheel, Mama, because I'm one annulled son of a bitch."
I threw my hands up in the air, and Lucy leaned over and gained control of the wheel.
Lucy said, "I think not being born might be the nicest gift I could ever bestow on my children. It wasn't a happy home I raised you up in."
"Au contraire, it was a dream come true," I said.
"Starring the bastard McCall children, their virgin mother, and their pickled father who would later be cuckolded and emasculated by the Pope himself."
"When your father gets the news, I want to know every single word that comes out of his mouth. I'll cherish every syllable of his pain."
"You shouldn't have hard feelings about Dad," I said, taking control of the wheel again. "After all, you were never married to him."
"I don't have to be bitter anymore. It's like it never happened. Perhaps we could even be friends."
"I could introduce you," I offered. "Judge McCall, I'd like you to meet Mrs. Pitts. The Pope has quashed all rumors that you were once husband and wife, and that you produced 5 children during your long and ghastly marriage."
"Now you're making fun," Lucy cautioned.
"The Roman Catholic Church," I said, shaking my head. "Why did you raise me in such a ridiculous, brain-dead, dim-witted, sexually perverse, odd-duck, know-nothing, silly-ass church? We're Southern, for God's sake, Mama. I could have been an Anglican and had a nice golf stroke. Presbyterian, and I could have had a puckered asshole and been able to clear my throat with authority. Methodist, and not gagged when someone melted marshmallows on sweet potatoes. Baptist, and I could have drunk in secret with great pleasure. Church of God, and I could have spoken in unknown tongues. But no, you condemn me to weirdness and freakdom and solitude by raising me in the only church that could mark me as a loser in paradise among my peers."
"I raised my children in the Cadillac of religions," said Lucy.
"We are not your real children," I said. "The marriage was annulled. You can forget about morning sickness, the pain of childbirth, messy placentas, 2 o'clock feedings, measles, chicken pox. None of it happened. Your kids are 5 little nightmares you never had."
"The Cadillac," she said. "The top of the line."
And she leaned her head back and closed her eyes. Lucy said, after miles of silence,
"I want Father Jude to hear my confession. Nothing else will quite do."
"Tell me why Father Jude is so important to you." I could tell I had asked a question my mother didn't like, and she paused for a long moment before answering.
"Later, I'm not going to let you ruin my day," Lucy said. "You always try to make me feel bad about the way I raised you. Well, here's the bottom line. You got a college education, a pretty child, and you have written a bunch of books with your name and picture on each one. And you try to make me feel like I did a bad job. You had a great childhood."
"Yeah, I sure lucked out."
You don't even know what bad luck looks like.
Tell me about my luck, I said, trying to sound ironic, not bitter, but bitterness leaked out all over the irony.
When you were hit, you bled just like me, Lucy said, but you did your bleeding in a warm bed, with a full stomach and with your mama coming in to press a cold washcloth to your face.
When I was a little boy, you used to tell me you grew up in Atlanta.
I spent some time in Atlanta, Lucy said defensively.
You had a photograph of your parents on your bedside table.
It was a good story, Lucy said. It fooled your father.
I looked over at her and said, but not Ginny Penn.
Heavens no, not Ginny Penn. She knew I came from nothing the moment she laid eyes on me.
Well, what's the deal? I said.
Lucy didn't say anything for a few moments.
It took Ginny Penn a while to check out my story, but she got round to it by and by, and by the time she discovered the truth, I'd already dropped three of her grandchildren and had another on the way. By then, your daddy was personally trying to make a success out of that Jack Daniels distillery operation up in Tennessee. Ginny Penn realized, no matter who was my kin, I was good enough to clean up her boy's vomit. I paid dearly for that little white lie.
Who were your parents?
You don't want to know, she said. They were less than nothing, beyond sorry. When the South does sorry, there's nothing sorrier on earth. That's how it was with my parents. Mama was sweet-natured, but pathetic and broken down the middle. Daddy was mean, but, like Mama used to say, only when he was awake.
Her laugh chilled me.
Mountain means different than other kinds of mean. A hotter kind of man develops in a place where the light don't get in till late morning. Daddy never saw enough light.
Did you love them?
Him? Never. Wasn't much to love. Couldn't get a grip on something worthwhile, she said. He didn't allow himself any soft places. I never saw him smile once.
Are they alive?
No, thank God, she said. Jude and I wouldn't be here to tell the tale if they were.
Jude and you? What do you mean?
I didn't say that, said Lucy.
Did your father drink?
Huh, Lucy snorted. He was a worse drinker than your father ever was.
No one's that bad, I said.
That's what I thought, too. You're too close to the middle line, inch over.
That's right.
You think you know what to look out for in life, Jack. You think your childhood teaches you all the traps you need to worry about, but that's not how it works. Pain doesn't travel in straight lines. It circles back around and comes up behind you. It's the circles that kill you.
We came to the road leading to the Abbey. The car moved through pools of undisturbed shade, giving me a lost feeling. The earth itself seemed to grow quiet as we approached the kneeling, tonsured nation of Mepkin. The forest unfurled itself in all the proud wildness of forbidden flags springing up in the outback. 100-year-old vines, like rigging, hung from the branches of river birch and bent oaks. As we turned into the long drive leading to the monastery, Lucy and I grew silent, as though we both were listening to secret commands. The weather itself lent a caved-in, hushed collusion to it all. I parked the car and walked over and rang the visitor's bell in the incensed air. Far off, we could hear the singing of monks. The buildings were new and looked like they were built for hillsides in California, not the South. Father Jude appeared at the end of a pathway, his hands folded and invisible under his sleeves, walking with his head bent slightly forward. He and Lucy embraced and held each other for a long time. Jude looked insubstantial and vegetal, his pale flesh like the white asparagus famous in the Argenteuil region of France. The priest had a lived-in, tortured face, yet I knew the man had almost no experience in the outside world, and I wondered at the withheld intimacy between them as I watched Father Jude lead Lucy into the chapel where Mass was being said. After the service, I excused myself and went to the library, where I spent the afternoon writing letters and glancing through the odd selection of magazines that passed muster with a censorious monk responsible for ordering periodicals for the Abbey. Lucy explored the grounds of the Abbey with Jude, and even though they had asked me to join them, I felt they preferred to spend their time alone with each other. I envied the private, cut-off quality of contemplative life. I admired the intransigence of their discipline, and in a century that seemed more ridiculous to me with each passing year, I thought that solitude and prayer and poverty might be the most eloquent and defensible response to these absurd times, where alienation was both posture and philosophy. I loved the simplicity of monks, and longed to emulate their all-consuming, uncomplicated love of God. I liked the idea of denial and silence, but doubted I could take gracefully to their practice. On the ride back to Waterford, night moved slowly into the lowlands, and Lucy's weariness was obvious as we drove between the light-infused trees that crowded the highway. Her exhaustion worried me, and I imagined the approach of the white cells massing along the contested borders of her bloodstream. Once I had nested within her, fed on the warm river that bloomed inside her, learned to love the safety of the darkness of women, come to know the serenity in the music of heartbeats, and that mother love begins in the temple of the womb, a stained glass window that celebrates the origins and elixirs of blood-borne life. The blood that fed me, I thought, is killing her. This is why people believe in gods and need them during the black hours beneath the cold light of stars, I said to myself. Nothing else could touch the lordly indifference of the world. My mother there, I thought. It was in her I first knew of Eden and the planet I was about to enter, naked and afraid. Quit thinking about my funeral, Lucy said, her eyes still shut. I'm not dead yet, just bone tired. I was thinking how odd it was to live in a state where you can't even get decent Chinese food. You're lying, she said. You had me dead and buried. Why don't I murder Dad? I said. We can all have a dry run to see what a parent's death feels like. But because it's just Dad, none of us have to be emotionally involved. Don't talk about your father like that, my mother ordered. He's not my father, I said. Don't forget the annulment and the shame that is ours now that we're bastards. What do you know about shame, son? Lucy asked, sitting up and smoothing out the wrinkles in her dress. Opening her purse, she took out an atomizer and sprayed White Shoulders cologne on her wrist, and the car carried the full story of my childhood into the airstreams of the highway. A lot. I know a lot about shame. She shook her head and rubbed the perfume into her throat and face. It hurts Jude that you left the church, she said. It's none of his business, I said. He baptized all my boys, gave you First Communion, she said. We used to think you two were lovers, I said. I told him that when he gave you the last rites. She laughed and said, What did he say? Not much. Personality's not his long suit. Jude told me it was time, my mother said, closing her eyes. Time for what? To put the cards on the table, she said. Back to shame again, huh? I said. Yeah, it always leads back there, Lucy said. Father Jude's my brother, Jack, your uncle. Odd, I said, after driving another mile of Carolina Highway in silence. Even for you, odd. I got caught up in my own lie, never could figure out how to backtrack and start again. I could face anything but Jenny Penn's contempt, know what I mean? No. I said honestly. I've no idea. It's traditional in most southern families to introduce worthy young nephews to their blood uncles long before their 37th birthdays. Lucy laughed, then said, You're so old-fashioned. Well, even for us, Mama, this is too screwed up. Frankly, I wish Father Jude had just been your lover. It'd be so much easier to swallow. It made perfect sense to me, she said, once upon a time. I can't wait to hear the details, I said, driving. Then I shouted out the window, The ghastly fucking unbelievable details! Compose yourself, Lucy said, and she began to tell the story. I listened. Chapter 27 The truth is that Lucy McCall was born a Dillard, on dirty sheets in a three-room shotgun house, within earshot of the Horse Pasture River, in the county of Peltzer, in the mountains of North Carolina. There was not a dentist or a doctor within 100 miles of where she was born, and few people over 40 in the valley who still had their own teeth. Her father, A.J. Dillard, said he was a farmer, but he was neither an industrious nor a successful one. He drank when he should have been sowing, and he drank all the way through harvest time and through the first snow. His daughter never learned what the initials A.J. stood for, and no one ever mentioned her mother's maiden name. Her mother's first name was Margaret. Her brother, Jude, was born 2 years after she was, on the same dirty sheets. Again, the father was passed out drunk, and Margaret delivered the child by herself, in silence, without making a single sound that might rouse her husband from his drunken slumber. She was always proud that she never asked for help, nor asked to be beaten. The latter was something he always thought up for himself. Wife-beating was both an itch and a pastime with A.J. Dillard, one that he had learned at the knee of his own father. No one in the family on either side could read or write. One had to travel to Asheville to find a copy of any book except the Bible. It was common for children to die in infancy in those parts, and broken-down women such as Margaret prayed for those merciful deaths. Later, Margaret used to dream that her children were taken to see Jesus right after their deaths, and fitted out with the prettiest angel wings made out of lace and snow. Margaret was 12 years old when Lucy was born, 14 when Jude arrived. In her portion of Appalachia, Peltsa County, she was not looked upon as a particularly young mother, but neighbors did pity her as an unlucky one. No one ever wasted breath by saying a good word about A.J. Dillard. A Dillard was the lowest form a white man could take in that part of the world, an all-white county with an unwritten sunshine law forbidden black people inside the county line after the sun went down. When the Depression finally struck America, no one in Peltsa County noticed anything different in their economy at all. Lucy was born hungry, and Margaret's milk flow was thin and weak, and Lucy would stay hungry through most of her childhood. Lucy never could pin down the exact moment when she understood that her father was dangerous. She grew up seeing blood and bruises on her mother's face, and thought that it was natural for a husband and wife to beat each other with fists. The beatings altered the way her mother looked, and as the years passed, Margaret's eyes would grow more troubled, and the shape of her jaw and cheekbones would set into different angles as the bones were broken and rebroken. But Lucy always remembered her mother's sweetness. When she was 5 and Jude 3, her father went down from the mountains and hired himself out as a laborer on a tobacco farm outside of Raleigh. Sometimes he would come back for the winter, and sometimes he would send back money by mail, but he became less and less a part of their lives in the next 5 years. Margaret blossomed in his absence, and discovered she could coax more crops from the rock-strewn field than her husband ever could. She raised chickens and quail and bees in the yard around her unpainted house. Lucy and Jude learned how to fish with cane poles and worms along the bank of the Horse Pasture River, and caught trout for dinner much of the year. Margaret could use a shotgun as well as any man in the valley, and she traded deer and bear she had shot for supplies she needed for the farm. By the time she was 10, Lucy could use a shotgun as well as her mother, and took pride in the sore place on her shoulder when she went to bed after a successful hunt. She had cut her teeth on her father's .22 rifle, and no squirrel or rabbit or possum was safe when she entered the forest. That .22 became a part of her, and she would handle it as smoothly as she did a rolling pin when she was flattening out a batch of biscuit batter. Once she killed a wild turkey after stalking it all day. It was a full-grown gobbler, a beast of such grandeur and wildness that she found herself admiring its cunning as it fled through thickets of blackberry and wild rose, moving swiftly as a racehorse as she followed its prints, large as a boy's hand, when it crossed through giveaway patches of earth. The churches of Appalachia during Lucy's years worshipped a severe and unforgiving God. Though illiterate, both Margaret and A.J.'s families were God-besotted and extreme in their beliefs. Their faith was hardcore, uncompromising, and single-minded in its intensity. At the height of their ecstasy, communion with the Lord, the Church of the Primitive God and His Saints passed poisonous snakes back and forth among the pale-throated, righteous congregation, who believed that the serpents would not harm them if their faith in God was sincere. Lucy could remember the Sabbath when two men failed the test and lay writhing on the floor, felled by an eastern diamondback that was making his debut appearance. One of the men, struck in the eyeball, died within minutes. When they buried Okey Shivers, the preacher exhorted his flock to try to live better lives, and promised all of them that he had received a divine vision of Okey rather than in hellfire for all eternity, the fangs of that serpent still attached to his eyeball. The preacher was named Boy Tommy Green, and the Lord had appeared to him in a burning chariot near a field below Chimney Rock, and called him in a voice like thunder to the ministry of snakes. He screamed out his sermons, which he never wrote down, nor did he ever purr out the name of Jesus. The word Jesus scissored through the air when Boy Tommy spoke, and he wielded the name like a sound to frighten the mountain-broken sinners who came to his church for relief and succor. Eternal life seemed especially sweet to folk who had eaten songbirds and stray dogs for dinner, and who tried to coax measly crops from fields more granite than loam. Like most mountain men in that region, A.J. made his own liquor high above the Horse Pasture River whenever the tobacco season ended and he had worn out all his welcomes everywhere else. As the years passed, his homecomings became dreaded events, and Lucy could never remember her father gentle or sober. Everything about him was as hard as an outcropping of stone. The beating of his wife and children was sport to him, one he could indulge upon waking, half-drunk and hungover, when he could run his family down, slap them for sins of which they were completely innocent, then grow morose and sorrowful as the cycle began anew when he took his first sip of clear whiskey. In midwinter, Lucy and Jude would pray for tobacco to begin blooming in central North Carolina fields. They had learned that husbands were masters of their own houses, and that men held dominion over women and children and all the beasts of the field. But it was Boy Tommy who was destined to deliver all of them from the wrath and natural meanness of their father. Boy Tommy could speak in the unknown tongues and quote the Gospel of Luke from the beginning to the end without once glancing down at the Bible. He was a wonder when it came to the things of the Lord, but could not be considered a saintly man because his eye for women was as advanced as his biblical knowledge. Boy Tommy made his visits to the Dillard farm always during the height of tobacco season, when he was sure A.J. was gone. Before he would enter the house for a Bible reading with Margaret, he would drop a copperhead onto the bare dirt ground and give long sticks to Lucy and little Jude and teach them how to race a snake around the yard, making sure you didn't lose the snake to either the river or the woods. The snake bore the coloring of an October path, and as the children teased the snake, Boy Tommy gave spiritual encouragement to Margaret inside the three-room house. A.J. returned in early September one year, unannounced, his arm broken and set badly, splinted by a self-taught doctor who patched up migrant workers who cut each other up in fights or were injured in the tobacco fields. A.J. possessed an illiterate's intuition, and he took the scene in quickly as he saw his children lifting a snake high into the sunlight with a stick, unattended to in the unearthly quiet of a late afternoon. When he found Boy Tommy on top of his wife, both naked as the day they were born, he killed Boy Tommy with a single blow from an axe. The axe cleaved the preacher's brain in half, and his blood splattered against two walls and over Margaret's face. A.J. rubbed her lover's blood over Margaret's face and neck, smearing pieces of his brain all over her breasts and stomach. He beat her face until her blood and Boy Tommy's blood commingled into something love-born and sacramental. He beat her with his good hand until he knew he had broken that hand and the bones in her face. Then he dragged her and kicked her naked out into the yard before the eyes of the yard fowl and mule and two stricken, terrified children. A.J. took her to the Horse Pasture River, cursing God's name and his wife's name, and the both of them covered with a dead man's blood. And he plunged Margaret's face into a deep chute of water, which ran scarlet from her wounds. He held her there for a moment, then brought her up to air and light, to tell her to prepare to die in water, as the Lord had commanded them to be reborn in the same waters of life. The screams of his wife were nothing compared to his fury and the righteousness of his vengeance. But a mistake was made, a terrible, unrecallable error that he lived long enough and in enough agony to regret. A.J. had not heeded the silence of his bitter, pretty daughter, the one who was moving toward the river with a copperhead turned around the end of a long pole, a snake she had learned to love and trust. AJ took Margaret by the throat and struck her head against a rock that had a sharp place on it, opening up the back of her head, and a new flag of blood unfurled in the waters. But underwater, she heard the faraway, subdued cry of her husband, who did not see the girl place the serpent around his neck, making it a loose-fitting collar, mountain-hued and vibrant. The fangs hit his wing bone first, then sent a second dosage of venom near the coccyx. It was there that AJ caught the snake and hurled it into the water, where it was swept downstream toward a deep trout pool, where the copperhead reached the far bank and slithered off into the forest after its long captivity among the saved. When he let Margaret go, she too was taken by the river, tumbling down a short rapids. She would have drowned, but she caught hold of the exposed roots of a sycamore tree and hung on until she regained both her breath and a sense of where she was. She watched Lucy and little Jude sprinting up a path that led straight up the side of a mountain, with AJ in pursuit, but his pace slowed with each step taken. His hand kept searching for marks on his back he could not seem to find, his good fingers groping to find whatever it was that was paining him. Once or twice he howled, then turned back looking for his wife. The poisons burned inside his veins, but he could still function in his rage well enough to drag the corpse of boy Tommy to the river and spit as he let the swift current take the body to the first falls, where it stuck between two rocks. Margaret watched in horror as the corpse sat up in the current and boy Tommy's mouth and dead eyes opened and white water poured over his shoulders. She held on to the roots, the cold water slowing her heartbeat and her blood flow, and she did not dare pull herself from the river until it was near darkness, and she believed all the rage and pain of her husband had subsided. Bringing some of the river with her, she trailed that same water into her house, looking for her children, who watched the scene from a boulder that gave them an overview of the farm where their childhood had gone wrong. She knew by heart where everything in her house was placed, and she went to a kerosene lamp and the drawer where she kept matches, and lit a light that took a bite out of the gloom. Walking out in the yard, she lifted the lantern to her face, so her children could see her if they were hidden away but keeping watch. She called for them in the owl's voice she could imitate perfectly. Later, both children would remember this haunting mimicry of owls more than the sound of her own voice. Quiet as algae, they hung on the rock, waiting to see if their father would appear to strike down their mother. The whole mountain seemed endangered by his arrival. Sensing the quiet, Lucy gave a signal by squeezing her brother's arm, and they moved toward their house down a stony path they knew by heart. They met their mother bringing a great length of thick rope out of the barn, and the nervousness of disturbed chickens made the night noisy, unsettled. The river's voice calmed them as they neared the hard, grassless yard. "Harness the mule," their mother said to the night more than to Lucy or Jude, and both children moved toward the barn as Margaret entered the house with a length of rope, so heavy she staggered while carrying it. The lantern light poured out into the yard, feral and yellow as a hawk's eye. There was great economy to her movement after she decided what she had to do. Drunk, on his back and snoring, AJ lay on the bloody bed where he had killed boy Tommy and where both their children had been conceived in all the sorrow of their cut-off, circumscribed lives. His throat was swollen from the poison. AJ did not feel the rope as Margaret threw it over his chest and tied it tightly against the bed's steel frame. She then wound the rope round him, going under the bed and crawling to the other side, and pulling the rope tight against his body. As patiently as a garden spider, she wrapped him in a rope thick enough to tether a full-grown bull. Over his body and under the bed, she pulled the rope tight against him, until he looked like a moth enfolded in deadly silk. She wanted there to be no chance of escape, because she now knew what the stakes were and what hatred tasted like on the tongue and in the pit of the stomach. Margaret did not own a mirror and would have chosen not to look at herself as she felt the rough, hurt places on her face, traced them with an index finger that had been hurt on the rocks. Every time she moved, she could feel the broken places catch on fire in her central nervous system. But she worked slowly, methodically, and she had a plan. She helped her children load all the food in the house in the wagon, and all their clothes and blankets and provisions. The children followed her commands to the letter and did not speak. She had become spectral to them, a strange woman holy enough to sleep with the man beloved by serpents, and married to a man frenzied enough to try to kill them both. Margaret went to the river and picked up a rock the size of a child's shoe. She liked the feel of it, its heft and weight and shape. She told her children to get into the wagon and try to fall asleep amid the bed linen and clothing. Jude fell asleep immediately, but Lucy only pretended to sleep, and watched her mother go back into the house where the light was, and where much of the knowledge she would take through her life about the relationship of men and women was about to reveal itself. A.J. Dillard awoke to the terrible pain of the snake bite on his back and shoulders, which was serious enough to torture but not to kill him. The whiskey had dulled its sharpness before he had passed out unconscious on his bed. His mouth was dry, and he needed a drink of water when he woke from a dreamless, restless sleep. His mouth tasted of cotton and sand, and he began weeping as he felt his wounds burning and tried to turn over, but felt the rope roughly cut into the veins of his throat. He screamed out Margaret's name and was sorry when she answered his call.
"Untie me, woman,"
he ordered, as he saw her shadow enter the room, but he was in far too much pain to notice details. It was the detail of the stone in her hand that he failed to notice.
"Then I'm going to finish killing you, then the girl what put a snake on me."
"You won't be leaving that bed," the woman said, moving toward him.
"A drink of water, then, if you're meaning to kill me."
"No water needed where you be going," Margaret said, climbing into the bed and straddling him between her legs, sitting on his chest, staring into his eyes.
"I beat you ugly," he said, laughing through his pain.
"You beat me for the last time," his wife said, and struck him in the head with the stone. He screamed once, and the second blow caved in the upper bridge of his teeth. She kept striking his head and face until she could not recognize it as his face at all. It was covered over with blood and snot and tears. Lucy took it for as long as she could, then could no longer stand the sound of her father's begging. He kept saying he was sorry for all he had done and wasn't ready to leave this life yet and face the wrath of eternal judgment. The more blood he lost, the more religious he became, and the more he began to sound like boy Tommy. Lucy ran to her mother and tried to pull her off her father, but the woman was unloosed in her fury and would not tolerate restraining. She hit her husband's face again and again until her arm grew tired. Then she went to a bucket of water and washed her hands and face clean of all traces of his blood. Finally, her mother began to pour kerosene on the pine floorboards, spilling it over the curtains and makeshift furniture without any concern for waste or the future. Though Lucy did not understand why her mother was spreading kerosene all over the table and wallboard, her father did, and he began to try to break the knots of the great rope by straining against them. He managed to lift the bed off the floor, and it moved slowly, inch by inch, across the room. But then Margaret poured the last of the kerosene all over him.
"You don't have the guts,"
her husband said, but he knew little of the depths and the capacity for outrage his wife harbored in the secret caves and nests of her womanhood. From the doorway, Margaret Dillard said goodbye to her husband. "Kiss Satan for me, A.J.," and she hurled the lantern toward the bedroom and ran for the wagon. The noise of her father dying took Lucy out of the horse pasture valley and stayed with her down the long, treacherous dirt road that led out of those mountains toward Seneca, South Carolina. No one lived near enough to them to see the fire or heed A.J.'s agonized entreaties. Their mother never gave her house or mate another thought and concentrated on keeping the mule centered in the road. They encountered unasked-for kindness on that journey out of the mountains where Margaret had spent every hour of her hill-encircled life. Farmers' wives, keen with the expertise of their own solitude, recognized the daring, unspeakable impulse that had brought the broken-cheeked woman to their door begging for food. They fed her eggs and milk and cheese because she was a woman and because she had two children. None would have been so generous to a man traveling alone. For a solid month, they roamed the back roads and visited the small towns of South Carolina as Margaret tried to come up with a plan. She caught sight of her own face in a mirror at a farm she stayed in, outside of Clinton, South Carolina, and she wept when she saw the damage A.J. had inflicted. Once she had been proud of her prettiness, but now felt the peculiar shame that ugliness grants a woman at no extra charge. She did not believe a young man could ever fall in love with such a disfigured, undermined face. If she herself was repulsed by her own image in a mirror, she could not hope to attract the attention of any decent or kindly disposed man. Because she had no clear idea of what to do or where to settle, she kept on pushing her mule from town to town, hoping for a miracle. No miracle was in the making for Margaret Dillard and her children, and outside Newberry, her mule died. In the next town, she walked her children to the front gate of a Protestant-affiliated institution called the Orphanage of the Ministry of the Lamb, which was run by missionaries who had spent time preaching the word of God to sub-Saharan tribes in Africa. It was located on the road between Newberry and Prosperity in the town of Duffordville. It was built along a railroad track, and its houses had that anonymous blankness that small towns assume will keep disaster at bay. There was not a single note of vainglory in the architecture or setting of the town. At the entrance to the orphanage, Margaret pointed out the main building, a two-story wooden structure with shutterless windows and two unpainted Doric columns that looked like crutches holding up the house.
"They take orphans," Margaret said to her children. "That's where you live."
"But we have you," Lucy cried out. "We've got a mother."
"I know that," her mother said, but dreamily, absently.
That night they camped beneath a trestle and built a fire that warmed them, and Margaret fed her children the last scraps of food she had saved. Indecision had defeated her, and her eyes had given up on all thought of deliverance. She had prayed as hard as a being could pray, and the only thing she got out of it was a dead mule and a tired, overworked heart. Margaret Dillard sang a lullaby to her children and whispered to them that their faces looked beautiful in the firelight. While they slept, she kissed them and covered them with her own blanket and hung herself with a short piece of rope on the trestle above them. She looked upon her death as the last and only gift she could ever give to her children. The children woke to that gift. In the years that followed, Lucy could never say the word orphan aloud without the word quivering with a terrible resonance. To her, an orphan was a child where evil could come sweetly home to rest, an innocent surrendered as a sacrifice to harm's way. At age 10, Lucy Dillard had seen her father murdered and her mother hang by her neck from a train trestle, and she had every right to think that she had seen the worst the world had to offer a young girl. Then she met the Reverend Willis Bedenbaugh. Very early, Lucy learned that for ordinary people, an orphan was a hard thing to love. An orphan was something discarded, abandoned, and put out on the side of the road, completely dependent on the charity and sufferance of strangers. In stories and movies, it would later infuriate her to see orphans always taken in by generous, warm-hearted families who would treat them as though they had arrived in their midst the normal way. She learned that there were too many Willis Bedenbaughs in the world, and that they cut their teeth by preying on the orphans of the world. The Reverend Bedenbaugh was a softer version of the man of God than the ones the mountains of North Carolina made. He was proud of his milky complexion and his burnt blonde hair, which gave him the appearance of a large, self-satisfied peach. His shoes were expensive and immaculately shined by an 18-year-old orphan, brain-damaged and violent, who could never be placed with a Christian family. His name was Enoch, and he lived in a stall at the back of the barn. Since there was no school, the 18 orphans attended chapel twice a day, where they endured sermons by the Reverend that he read to them verbatim out of a book entitled The Art of the Sermon. His voice carried over the small chapel, and it had a brushed, soothing quality that Lucy found attractive. The Reverend Bedenbaugh was the first person she had ever known who had been to college. For the first couple of meetings, she and Jude wondered to themselves where the snakes were. They could not figure how a Christian would measure his love of Jesus if he didn't pass along a snake that could bite and kill him in the process. But they kept their own theology private and grew accustomed to the more rotund, constrained oratory of the South Carolina Midlands. The Reverend Bedenbaugh did not rape Lucy until she had been there a month. After he raped her, he dried her tears and read to her a long passage from Ephesians and warned her about the wantonness of every woman and how women's bodies drew out the lust in godly men. He rewarded her with a piece of licorice candy, and she hated the taste of licorice from that day forward. Lucy discovered that he did not rape all the orphan girls, but had his favorites, who received extra portions at dinner and were spared the more laborious chores on the orphan-run farm that supported them. When he drank, he would come to the large room where the orphans slept in bunk beds. He usually came at 3 in the morning to make his selection. All the girls he favored had to sleep on the bottom bunks, and none could wear panties. Soon, Lucy became his favorite prey, and she learned to hate the smell of scotch as much as she loathed the taste of licorice. One night, when the Reverend was inside her, Lucy opened her eyes and saw her brother Jude staring down at her in pity and fury, and with the helplessness of all boys who witness such a scene. She lifted her hand up toward him in the darkness, and Jude reached down and held her hand until the Reverend finished his business and rolled off her. Afterward, he would retire to his office on the same floor, read his Bible, and smoke his pipe. The smell of tobacco leaf would enter the lightless dormitory, and the children would drift off to sleep, knowing they were safe that night from further attacks. Then he would turn his kerosene lamp off and sleep on a small cot beside his desk. In November, he had raped a new girl the first night she slept in the orphanage. The others had heard her struggling and screaming in the darkness, and heard Reverend Bedenbaugh order her to shut her mouth and submit to the will of the Lord. They had also heard the moment he broke her neck. Before morning, Enoch had removed the girl and buried her next to Margaret Dillard in the pauper's graveyard that adjoined the orphanage. The drinking got worse after that, and it was then that Bedenbaugh began to favor Lucy, because she did not struggle and she made no sound. Her brother Jude made no sound either, but he held his sister's hand as she was violated on the bunk bed beneath him. After the attacks on his sister, Jude would watch every single movement Bedenbaugh made when he returned to his office. A large, unpaned window gave the preacher a view of the children's sleeping quarters, but it also enabled Jude to study him. When the Reverend sat in his chair, he made an elaborate ceremony out of smoking his pipe. He would clean the bowl carefully with his pocket knife, then ream out the stem with a clean, white pipe cleaner. He smoked Prince Albert's tobacco, which he kept in large tins on his desk. He would inhale the robust smell of the raw tobacco, then grab a large pinch with his thumb and forefinger, tamping it down tightly with a flat-headed tool that looked like a nail to Jude. Then Bedenbaugh would take out a silver cigarette lighter, admire it in the lamplight, flick its small wheel with his thumb, and put the flame to the tobacco, whose smell would soon drift into the room and put Jude to sleep. The Reverend Bedenbaugh would then finish a pint bottle of scotch before he fell into a heavy sleep, punctuated by deep, comical snoring. It took Jude over a month to come up with the plan he was praying for in chapel twice a day. That night, after the Reverend had returned to his office and he could hear Lucy weeping quietly, Jude watched the post-coital ceremonies and ablutions take place through the lit window. Even Lucy was asleep when the young boy moved like a cat from his upper bunk and made his way to the office door of Willis Bedenbaugh. He wanted to make Reverend Bedenbaugh deeply regret the fact that he had chosen to violate the sister of Jude Dillard, who was mountain-born and carried some of the rage of the mountain folk as his birthright. He waited for the snoring to begin, and once it began, Jude entered the office. The soft form slept and snored beneath a feather comforter. Jude went to the desk and saw the flaming eye of the pipe, still lit in the ashtray, smoldering and angry. He opened the first drawer on the right, as he had often seen Bedenbaugh do, and he reached in and felt the tin can filled with fluid for the silver cigarette lighter. He found the cigarette lighter beside the pipe, and he took that in his left hand and kept the lighter fluid in his right. His mother had done it differently, but his idea was much the same. Her strength had been in her resolution, in the fact that she had formed a plan. He wished he were older so he could understand more, but he was old enough to realize that he could not hold his sister's hand another time without dying of shame. He removed the tiny red top of the lighter fluid, and he began to apply it to the feather comforter that covered the Reverend. The can made a squeaky sound, so he tried to time it with the man snoring. Jude was patient and thorough, and though it took him almost a half hour, he managed to empty the tin can without spilling a drop on himself. For another 10 minutes, he tried to summon the courage to light the lighter. He had never lit a cigarette lighter, and had only watched Reverend Bedenbaugh do it. He felt the rough wheel with his thumb. In his imagination, he spun it, and it leapt with a flame that jumped to the roof of the orphanage. He flicked it once, but nothing happened, except a small scratching noise, like a rodent loose in a box. The sound changed the rhythm of the minister's snoring, and Jude waited a full minute before daring to try again. The second time was no better, and again the minister stirred in his sleep. On the third time, Bedenbaugh woke up and smelled the lighter fluid that had leaked onto his nightshirt, soaking it. It took Jude 4 times to learn how to work a cigarette lighter.
"What are you doing out of bed?" the man demanded, slurring the words.
The lighter ignited, and before the boy touched it to the comforter, he sang in a clear voice, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." Then he set the man afire, and Bedenbaugh exploded into light, rising out of his bed and running with his bedclothes on fire. He ran through the dormitory screaming, and with each step he became more of a torch and less of a man. He burned increasingly brighter, and his tongue, untouched by fire, could only make noise, not words. At the end of the room, his hair ignited the dark cotton drapes, as his body, crisped and blackened, sank to the floor on his knees, and he died full of the smell of his own ruined, black-dappled flesh. Jude Dillard watched the man on fire drop on the other side of the room, noticed the sleeve of fire climbing up the drapery, and realized that, at the age of 8, he had just killed his first man, and felt that cleanliness of the spirit that justice always leaves as its signature. In his mind's eye, the burning shape of that man would stay with him always. Every confession or act of contrition he ever made included his remorse over the death of Willis Bedenbaugh. In nightmare after nightmare, Bedenbaugh would blend with his father in a terrible twinship, and their mutual screams would teach the sleeping priest again and again about the penalties of fire. His contemplative, buried life began as he watched his enemy fall to the pinewood floor and heard the voices of orphans screaming out the word, "Fire." It also marked the beginnings of his life of silence, and Jude could not utter a word for a full 2 years after the burning of the orphanage. Lucy led him out of the fire by the hand, and he followed as obedient as prey toward whatever fate awaited him after his only murder. The frame building burned all night and took over half the jobs of the village into the air with it. The general consensus was that Bedenbaugh had fallen asleep after finishing his half pint of scotch, and the ashes of his pipe had set his bedclothes on fire. He was the only fatality in a disaster that he himself had caused, and the villagers saw some glimmer of justice in the incident. Bedenbaugh's remains were quickly buried and quickly forgotten, for little more than teeth and bones were raked out of the charred ruins. A temporary home was set up in the girls' dormitory of Newberry College, and a quick dispersal of the orphans began as a call for help went out among the farm families of the Piedmont. A tobacco farmer near Florence selected Jude from a lineup, but was dissuaded from taking him by Lucy, who insisted that no one would separate brother and sister and split up what little family still existed for both of them. When the college students returned to Newberry College after their summer break, Lucy and Jude were the only two survivors of the orphanage fire who had not found homes. Lucy longed for softness and deliverance in the eyes of people who came to look at her and her brother with the same appraising eyes with which they judged livestock. But she knew that nothing was more unplaced or expendable than an orphan. By aligning herself with a speechless, damaged brother, she made herself unadoptable, unplaceable. Each day in Newberry, her eyes hardened, and she gained a source of interior strength as she began to understand the burden of being judged worthless. Her character formed that summer. Lucy would be living proof that you get in the way of a child savaged by fate at your own risk. By watching over her brother's interests, she transformed herself. In September, Lucy overheard a conversation in which the chaplain of the college spoke with the proctor of the girls' dorm about the possibility of committing Jude to the state mental hospital on Bull Street in Columbia. She had heard of peculiar children being sent to Bull Street and never being allowed to leave that institution again. But Lucy decided that she and her brother had been born to enough sorrow. She alone knew that her brother had reduced himself to a state of contrition that overwhelmed and hamstrung his every waking moment. He was a soft boy, a songbird, who had lost its music to the fear of hawks. Jude needed a strong sister, and strong she became. He had made her rapist pay a horrific price for her deflowering, and she would protect him from the cells that muffled the cries of the insane. For 2 days she stole food from the college kitchen, stockpiling it beneath her cot. From a poor box in the Anglican chapel, Lucy stuck a piece of chewing gum tossed away by a Newbury co-ed to a long stick and raised up 86 cents as if by magic. She absolved herself of all guilt by explaining to her unobjectioning brother that they were as poor as anyone who would receive comfort from the coins in that poor box. That night they slipped away from the dormitory. Leading her brother by the hand, Lucy walked him through the sleeping, indrawn town to the outbound street she had heard called the Columbia Highway. For 8 hours she forced marched them both, putting miles between themselves and the town. They wandered the back roads of South Carolina for a month, sleeping in clearings in the forests, in fields of corn, in haylofts and stables. At night they moved from place to place, distrustful as all nocturnal creatures are, and they learned to relish the taste of raw eggs and warm milk fresh from a cow. They gleaned and foraged where they could around the outskirts of farms. By accident, they made their way toward the coast, avoiding Columbia because they dreaded the connotation of Bull Street and the asylum. Since they started out only after sunset, they grew comfortable with starlight, and they moved down dirt roads sided by deep fields of ripening crops and under a night sky ablaze with constellations they could not name. Because neither child had spent a day in school, the world held very few names for them. Hand in hand, they traversed the state of South Carolina unnoticed. They left broken eggshells to mark their trail and gorged themselves on wild fruit and crab apples. They watched a drunken farmer club a dog to death that had killed a chicken, and that night, over a fire that could be seen for miles, they ate the chicken, and Lucy laughed for years over the thought that Jude had also wanted to take and eat the dog. She learned on that queer odyssey through darkness that hunger expands the horizons of one's recognized cuisines. The love they felt for each other sustained them, and both would look back upon this long, adult-free journey as the happiest days of their scarred, ill-fated childhood. Without plan, they drifted in an aimless, sleepwalking fashion, beneath trees now embroidered with long scarves of moss and palms, bringing news of the coast. The earth itself changed perceptibly beneath their feet, becoming sandier and more acidic. Invisibly, the water table rose, and cypress swamps began to echo with the night colloquies of owls and the territorial cry of a bull gator, alarmed by the approach of a rival on the waters inky with silt and seed and algae. They passed through the forests unnoticed by the thousands of eyes that scanned the sunless, foreclosed world, where most were hunters and all were prey. As citizens of the night, there was a fairyland quality to their sense of movement. Since Jude could still not talk, Lucy made all decisions, such as where they would hide during the daylight hours. They roamed until they started to weaken, and once they started to weaken, they quickly began to die. When she could not waken Jude from his starved-out sleep, Lucy walked directly toward the smoke rising from an unpainted farmhouse. Without hesitation, she knocked on the door, and the first black woman she ever would speak to answered the door. The black woman's name was Lotus, and it was a day of deliverance for Lucy and her unconscious brother. Lucy could not have brought her brother to a home of poorer people, or one more enlivened by a natural generosity of spirit. When Jude awoke, he was sucking on the little finger of a huge black woman who had dipped it into a jar of molasses her husband had milled himself. She had spread the molasses along Jude's gums and teeth. As a small girl, Lotus had known great deprivation herself, and so she set to the task of fattening up the two white children who appeared out of nowhere at her front door on the edge of the Congaree Swamp. For 3 weeks, Lotus fattened her foundling white children, watching the color rise in their cheeks as she fed them with biscuits slathered with butter, bacon cooked crisp in a steel frying pan, and all the eggs she could get them to eat. At lunch and dinner, she cooked every kind of bean and vegetable she could coax from her garden, and they feasted on cabbage and field peas and okra and pickled beets. Lotus made their bloodstreams electric with fat and iron and vitamins. But a farmer moving a load of hay toward Orangeburg saw the two white children playing in the yard of a black family and reported it to a magistrate he struck up a conversation with in a crossroads feed store 4 miles away. His duty done, the farmer continued with his hay toward Orangeburg and his anonymous life, but not before the lives of Lucy and Jude Dillard were once more about to be altered. Since it was against the law for black and white people to cohabitate, Sheriff Whittier simply took possession of Lucy and Jude, put them in the back seat of his car, and drove them to the county jail, where he put the two children up for the night. Again, they found themselves unwanted and without value, and they were moved from jail to Parish House until they were put on a train to Charleston with a circuit judge, who turned them over to a terrifying woman dressed in a black, hooded robe, who welcomed them to St. Ursula's Catholic Orphanage in Charleston. On a quiet street, tree-lined and moss-dappled, the children landed in a bizarre world of golden chalices and incense and splendidly cassocked priests who murmured in Latin. But they came to Catholicism without prejudice, since they had never seen a Catholic or heard of that religion in their entire lives. At first, they were amazed by its rituals and exoticism. The effigies of Jesus and the saints frightened them with their silent domination of niches and corners of the church, and it seemed to Lucy one could go nowhere to escape the disapproving gazes of those lidless, all-seeing icons. The nuns and priests seemed otherworldly, and were the first adults Lucy had encountered who dressed unlike the rest of humanity, but rather in imitation of the plaster of Paris statues they worshipped, with folded hands and strings of black stone. From the beginning, Jude flowered in the greenhouse environment he encountered in the good-hearted discipline of the nuns. He loved their strictness and passion for order. His silence they took as a sign of both saintliness and discipline, and they favored him from the first day. One nun, Sister John Appassionata, took a special interest in Jude, and under her devoted care, he found his voice again. She taught him the alphabet, and before long had him reading first-grade textbooks from beginning to end and doing subtraction problems. His mind was quick, and he learned things in a hurry. Lucy's experience at the orphanage was not as successful. After the soft ministrations of Lotus, Lucy felt more like an inmate at St. Ursula's than welcomed guest. The sister in charge of the girls' ward was a tight-lipped, straight-backed woman who tolerated neither laxness nor levity among the 16 girls assigned to her dormitory. The world frightened her, and she made sure she transferred that fear to all the girls in her charge. She taught them to hate their bodies because they had committed the unforgivable crime of being born female. In the Bible, there was proof that God hated women when he highlighted their subordination and created them second from a useless rib of Adam. The menstrual cycle gave testimony to woman's crime and her uncleanliness. Bernadine did not enjoy being a girl. So, the city of Charleston, a stain-windowed greenhouse of ferny richness and wall-eyed, leering perversion, became the vessel of rescue for the two wandering children who had been born unlucky in the mean South. Charleston broke its poor in the same way the mountains did, but the city camouflaged the soft emanations of evil. Charleston would prove to be a lucky city for Jude, and a very unlucky one for Lucy. Their lives divided here, and they would lose touch with each other for years. Jude would bloom under the tender gazes of nuns and priests, who would glow in the presence of his natural goodness, which began to take on an otherworldly quality as he grew older. The rituals of Catholicism would nurture him from his first days in St. Ursula's. He withdrew into a country of prayer, and, for him, that withdrawal contained the seeds of vocation. The common of the Mass was rich in both silence and language, and his spirit ripened in the luxury of its forms. Under the tutelage of John Appassionata, he asked that he and his sister be baptized in the Catholic cathedral as Roman Catholics. Thoroughly battle-hardened and cynical, Lucy saw the wisdom in this move and memorized the answers to catechism texts she heard the other girls reciting in class. Already the nuns had noticed that Lucy could not read or write a word, and she was openly referred to as retarded by Sister Bernadine. The word seemed to fix Lucy in time and made her invisible. Soon she ran away from St. Ursula's for the first time. She knew what it was like to be a runaway, but she was new at doing it alone or in a city. Lucy was 13 years old when she crossed East Bay Street and headed for the docks. Fast lessons would accrue to her, and she would learn that there was nothing more dangerous in the world than a young girl trying to make it on her own in the sad part of a city. A man bought her a train ticket to Atlanta, where she led a wanton, luckless existence until my father walked into her life. That's what passed for a lucky day in my mother's life. Chapter 28. Since the first day we had arrived in Waterford, Leah felt enormous pressure from all sides to be